You know, when you think about a master key to a bank vault, you probably picture something highly sophisticated, right?
Yeah.
Like a perfectly forged
Yeah.
fingerprint.
Right, like a retinal scan or something.
Exactly. Something straight out of a Hollywood heist movie.
Yeah, the assumption is always that it's high tech, you know, incredibly complex and requires some serious specialized equipment.
Right.
But the reality of modern financial crime is often much more mundane and, frankly, much more unsettling.
Which brings us to one of the largest financial fraud events in recent U.S. history.
Yeah.
Because the master key here, it wasn't high tech at all. The key was the identities of people who were, well, already locked up inside state and federal prisons.
It's just a staggering paradox, really. I mean, the individuals who are the most physically restricted in our society,
Yeah.
they actually became the perfect digital vehicles for billions of dollars in stolen government funds.
It's wild. Well, welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are taking you into the mechanics of a massive systemic failure. We've got our hands on a comprehensive report. It's titled Pandemic Benefit Fraud: How Stolen Identities Exploited Emergency Payment Systems.
It's quite a read.
It really is. And our mission for you today is to deconstruct exactly how these emergency systems fail under pressure, you know? Like why fragmented data is a fraudster's absolute best friend.
Oh, absolutely.
And what this reveals about the hidden vulnerabilities in the safety nets that are actually meant to protect you.
Yeah, and just setting the tone right up front here, while the sheer scale of pandemic fraud was unprecedented, the underlying mechanics, they're basically a masterclass in how financial crimes operate.
Right. It's not just a pandemic story.
Exactly. This goes far beyond a story about a single crisis. It's a really detailed exploration of how criminals relentlessly exploit the invisible gaps between different administrative silos.
So to understand a massive national level failure like this, we actually need to zoom all the way in first, right?
We do, yeah.
We need to look at a single, perfectly executed scheme just to see the mechanics at play. So enter Brooke Stewart from St. Joseph, Missouri.
Right, Brooke Stewart. Her case serves as the perfect microcosm for this whole thing.
How so?
Well, between May 2020 and June 2021, Stewart managed to steal, get this, $139,663 in CARES Act unemployment benefits.
Wow, over 139 grand.
Yeah, and the methodology is really what we need to focus on here because she didn't just invent fake people out of thin air.
Right.
She used the identities of five state or federal prison inmates, plus one other person alongside her own identity to, you know, facilitate these claims.
Which is just, I mean, using real people who were sitting in cells. But it did eventually catch up with her,
It
right?
did, yeah.
Because in May 2023, she pleaded guilty to stealing federal funds. And by October 2023, she was sentenced to 2.5 years in federal prison in order to repay all that money.
Which is a significant detail, but there's a more crucial detail to keep in mind here. Absolutely none of the incarcerated individuals whose identity she used actually received any of those fraudulent payments.
They got nothing.
Nothing. They were completely blind to it. I mean, they
Right.
were just the raw material for the crime. And another critical layer here is Stewart's background.
Oh, right. This wasn't her first time.
No, not at all. She was already on supervision for a 2019 state conviction for trafficking in stolen identities.
Wow.
So this completely dismantles that whole narrative that emergency systems were only being hit by, you know, random opportunists who just saw a loophole.
Right, like someone who just stumbled into it.
Exactly. These systems were actively targeted by experienced career criminals, people who brought existing data, established experience, and deep relationships in the identity crime underworld right to the government's front door.
You know, the report uses this phrase that I literally can't stop thinking about. They call it an artificial identity journey.
It's a great term.
It is. And here's how I picture it for you listening. Creating a fake ID from scratch, that's tedious, right? And banking algorithms are built to spot synthetic, entirely made-up identities.
They are, yeah.
So instead, it's like stealing a real person's car, keeping the registration completely valid so it passes any police inspection, but secretly changing the GPS so it drives the car straight to your house instead of theirs.
That is exactly it.
The identity is real, but the contact info and the bank destination are completely hijacked.
Yeah, the authorities are looking at the registration, right? They see the name, the date of birth, the social security number, and
It all checks out.
right, it all clears the primary checkpoints
Yeah.
because it belongs to a real verifiable person.
Wow.
The basic formatting checks built into these legacy government databases, they just see a valid checksum on the SSN and wave it right through.
So what's the flaw then?
The fatal flaw is that the system doesn't cross-reference the physical status of the person holding that registration.
Oh, I see.
Right. The person named on the file is physically sitting in a penitentiary, which makes them categorically ineligible and completely unavailable for unemployment.
Okay, so that leads me to my next question. Why specifically target people in prison? I mean, what is the mechanical advantage of pulling an inmate's data rather than, say, my data?
Well, it really comes down to the vulnerability of the incarcerated in a highly digitized economy.
Okay.
Their identities remain perfectly valid in government mainframes. You know, they have real social security numbers. They have real work histories.
Right.
But they are physically locked out of the digital world. They have highly constrained access to financial statements, to credit monitoring services, or to, like, any digital banking apps.
That makes sense. I mean, if someone steals my identity, I'm getting a push notification on my phone the second a new credit card is open, right?
Yeah, but an inmate has no phone.
Exactly. And no way to receive the mail either.
Oh, right. If the government sends out a suspicious tax document or some sort of benefit confirmation letter, it's going to go to a previous address or a drop house controlled by the fraudster.
So the victim literally never sees it.
Never. The fraud might remain completely undiscovered until years after the payment has been made.
Usually when they get out.
Yeah, usually when the inmate is released and, you know, tries to file legitimate taxes, they are administratively credible to a database, but practically unable to verify anything or file a complaint in the real world.
That is wild.
They're essentially ghosts in the machine.
But hang on, I do want to challenge this narrative for just a second.
Sure.
Because if a prisoner is sitting in a cell, couldn't they be in on the scam? I mean, they have phones smuggled in sometimes. They have families on the outside.
Right.
So how do investigators know the inmate isn't actually running the show from the inside, you know, splitting the cash?
Well, it's a fair point, and investigators absolutely have to assess that risk very carefully. The source notes that a payment associated with an incarcerated person can certainly involve collusion, coercion, or direct participation.
Okay.
But the danger for an investigator is assuming that just because an identity holder's name is on the paperwork, they somehow benefited from the crime.
Gotcha. You can't just assume.
Exactly. Like in Stewart's case, the financial forensics proved the inmates got nothing. You really cannot just victim blame the name on the file. You have to follow the routing numbers and the IP addresses.
And clearly the government started tracking those routing numbers.
Yeah.
Because the source points to this June 2026 Department of Labor Office of Inspector General audit.
Yes.
And they found a staggering $267.3 million in potentially fraudulent pandemic unemployment payments associated specifically with federal prisoners' Social Security numbers.
It's massive. Over a quarter of $1 billion just linked to the federal inmate population.
It's hard to even wrap your head around.
It really is. And that audit exposed a huge infrastructural weakness. Basically, state workforce agencies had wildly inconsistent access to the Social Security Administration's prisoner update processing system.
Which is known as PUPS, right?
Right, PUPS.
So wait, why wouldn't a state agency just log into PUPS and, like, check the list before cutting a check?
Well, you'd think so, but because government databases aren't built like modern web apps with seamless APIs.
Oh, right. Legacy tech.
Exactly. We're talking about state unemployment systems running on decades-old COBOL mainframes, and they're trying to communicate with a federal database.
Yikes.
Yeah, so if the states don't have the technical architecture to perform real-time cross-matches against PUPS, the claim just sails right through. The delay between an application and verification was the exact window these criminals needed.
Okay, so Brooke Stewart's $139,000 theft is shocking on its own. But the terrifying part is that she was just a tiny gear in a machine that ended up siphoning over $100 billion out of the U.S. economy.
Oh, yeah. This was an industrial-scale operation.
$100 billion.
At least. The Government Accountability Office estimates that fraudulent unemployment insurance payments between April 2020 and May 2023 were likely between $100 billion and $135 billion.
That is just an insane amount of money.
It is. And that wider pandemic relief environment affected at least 19 different federal programs, you know, including the Paycheck Protection Program and economic injury disaster loans.
So it wasn't just unemployment.
No, it was everywhere.
And this isn't over either. The report talks about this long enforcement tail because emergency fraud does not just vanish when the program closes.
Right.
By the end of 2024, at least 2,532 defendants had been found guilty of offenses involving these programs.
And nearly half of those defendants faced conspiracy charges.
Wait, really? Half?
Yeah, and that specific legal distinction is so important because it proves we are looking at organized crime syndicates here, not just lone wolves. And by January 2025, Department of Labor investigations resulted in more than 2,075 people being charged, over 1,500 convictions, and more than $1.1 billion in recovered funds.
$1.1 billion recovered out of what, $100 billion stolen?
Yeah. The asset recovery and the identity remediation for the victims, I mean, it will require decades of work.
So how does an operation scale to a $100 billion heist without collapsing the system immediately?
Well, the report outlines this perfect storm of conditions.
Okay, break it down for us.
First, you have the sheer speed and volume.
Which makes sense. I keep picturing, you know, a hospital emergency room after a massive earthquake.
Right.
Triage protocols take over, right? You weren't checking insurance cards or running background checks. You were just trying to stop the bleeding.
Exactly.
And the fraudsters, they just put on fake bandages and got right in the triage line.
That triage metaphor captures the reality perfectly. Because the pandemic forced the creation of the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, or PUA. Mm-hmm. So suddenly, states were mandated to process claims for self-employed and gig workers who had no traditional W-2 tax records on file.
Oh, so the normal checks were just gone.
Yeah, the foundational control of matching an employee's claim against an employer's payroll record was temporarily bypassed just to get the money out the door faster.
And doing this entirely remotely, I mean, that sounds like a dream scenario for anyone who just bought a hard drive full of data from the dark web.
Oh, absolutely.
You don't have to fake a face, just the paperwork.
Yeah. The dark web marketplaces provided the exact raw materials they needed. Criminals purchase what are known as full A's.
Full A's with a Z.
With a Z, yeah. They're complete packages of a person's identity. We're talking name, date of birth, social security number, and sometimes even mother's maiden names harvested from corporate data breaches.
So they have everything.
Everything. Yeah. And because physical unemployment offices were closed, claims were submitted using online forms and remotely controlled devices.
Right.
The fraudsters deployed automated bots to fire thousands of these full ads into state web portals simultaneously.
Thousands at once. Which I guess brings us to the fragmentation problem, right?
Exactly.
Because if I try to rob 10 banks in the same town in one day, the police are going to catch on. But here, a criminal could submit claims in California, Ohio, and New York at the exact same time.
Yep.
State agencies were operating entirely separate legacy systems. California's database wasn't talking to Ohio's database at all.
No, they were completely siloed. The criminals exploited the inability of states to run multi-state data matching in real time.
It's like they knew the exact blind spots.
Oh, they definitely did. And they didn't stop at unemployment either. Once you have a valid full A's package, you engage in what's called cross-program testing.
What's that?
It means that single stolen identity could be tested simultaneously against Small Business Administration loans, IRS tax credits, and state unemployment.
All at the same time.
Right. Separate, siloed federal and state agencies were approving apparently unrelated applications that all tied back to the exact same criminal actor sitting behind a single keyboard.
That is staggering. And the final piece of this puzzle is how they actually got their hands on the cash, right? Because you can't have $100 billion mailed to your house in physical checks.
No, definitely not. They utilized flexible disbursement methods. Fintech platforms and prepaid debit cards really revolutionized the speed at which money could be moved.
What?
Fraudsters would direct several different claimants' payments toward a single neobank account or a batch of prepaid cards they controlled, and then they'd instantly wire the funds overseas or, you know, convert them to cryptocurrency before anyone even noticed.
So we have all this fraud happening, massive amounts of money moving across borders. Hmm. Where were the traditional security controls? Like, why didn't the major banks catch this?
This brings us to the blind spots. The report relies on the concept of the blind men and the elephant.
Okay, I love this analogy.
Yeah, so government agencies and financial institutions, they were only observing their tiny, isolated parts of the transaction. The workforce agency, they only see the claimant's identity data in their eligibility declaration. They see a name and a seemingly valid work history.
Right, and then the bank, they only see the customer account, the incoming government direct deposit, and the outgoing ACH transfers.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, the prison authority only sees that the person is physically locked up in, like, cell block D.
Right. And because these databases are completely siloed, nobody sees the whole elephant.
Nobody sees the whole crime.
Exactly. And this creates a massive false equivalence that the entire system relied on. The government agency verifies that a social security number is real, and they treat that as confirmation of eligibility.
Which isn't the same thing.
Not at all. Verifying an identity exists does not prove that the person holding that SSN actually submitted the application or that they control the bank account the money is being sent to.
It's the difference between confirming a house exists on a map and confirming who actually holds the keys to the front door.
That is a perfect way to put it, yeah.
But I have to push back on the banks here, though, for a second.
Okay.
Because if I open a brand new bank account tomorrow, and suddenly 10 different government unemployment checks from 10 different states get deposited into it, shouldn't a giant red alarm go off at the bank?
Well, you're right. And FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, they did identify those exact anomalies as red flags.
They did?
Yes. Accounts receiving unemployment from states where the customer doesn't live. Multiple benefits going to one account,
yeah.
Rapid cash withdrawals, or peer-to-peer transfers right after a deposit.
So if they knew the red flags, what happened?
The issue wasn't a lack of awareness. It was the context of the crisis.
Meaning the system was just completely overwhelmed.
Yeah, it's about the noise in the system.
Oh.
During an emergency, you have unusually large volumes of legitimate public payments flowing everywhere.
Mm.
A college student might temporarily move back to a different state. A gig worker might legitimately receive payments from prior jobs in multiple states. Families were pooling relief checks into single accounts just to pay rent.
So the weird behavior actually looked normal for a minute.
Exactly. To a banking algorithm, a deposit coming from a verified U.S. Treasury routing number generally looks like incredibly low-risk money compared to, say, a wire transfer from an unknown offshore entity.
Wow, so the suspicious activity just becomes camouflaged by the flood of legitimate emergency funds.
Yep. Criminals knew they only needed to find one route through the application process and one financial destination that stayed operational just long enough to cash out.
They relied on the chaos of the triage tent to mask their signal.
Exactly right.
So what does this all mean for us now that we've, you know, diagnosed the disease and we've seen how easily these fragmented legacy systems are exploited? How do we cure it before the next crisis hits?
Well, the report lays out a really clear architectural roadmap for a resilient control stack. It requires moving away from reactive investigations and building proactive integrated defenses. So they break it down into 6 layers.
All right, what's layer 1?
The first layer is identity and eligibility separation. Programs must verify not just that an identity exists, but that the genuine person actually controls the application.
Okay, so breaking that false equivalence we talked about.
Exactly. This requires multi-factor authentication and device fingerprinting to really break that assumption of just checking if an SSN is valid.
Got it. What's the second layer?
The second layer is prepayment data matching. Before a single dollar is released, claims have to be checked against high-risk databases.
Which means checking PUPS.
Right. Pinging the PUPS system for incarcerated individuals, checking the Social Security death master files, and running multi-state claims checks before the ACH file is ever sent to the bank.
Okay, that makes total sense.
And that leads right into the third layer, which is recipient account verification. You have to establish a clear relationship between the claimant and the payment destination.
Which, honestly, on paper, matching the name on a claim to a bank account sounds incredibly basic. You're probably wondering why this wasn't happening already.
It does sound basic, yeah. But the reality is that legacy banking rails, like the ACH system, they don't always transmit the recipient name in a way that matches government databases perfectly.
Oh, like formatting issues?
Yeah. A middle initial mismatch or a maiden name could reject a valid desperate claimant.
Wow.
And criminals knew this threshold was deliberately lower to prevent bottlenecks during the pandemic. So establishing modern, frictionless name matching protocols is absolutely essential.
All right, so layer 4.
Then you need shared network intelligence. Agencies have to stop working in silos. They need to connect the technical dots across applications.
So they need to ask, are 50 different claims from 5 different states all routing through the exact same IP address?
Exactly, or the exact same device ID. The goal is to spot the organized infrastructure of the crime ring rather than just assessing every single individual claim in a vacuum.
Okay, that brings us to layer 5.
Right, which is financial institution monitoring. Banks have to elevate their monitoring. They must evaluate the velocity of funds.
Like how fast it's moving out of the account.
Exactly. They need to connect the incoming government payment info with the age of the account and the expected activity, flagging things like rapid peer-to-peer transfers of unemployment money for manual review.
Gotcha. And the final layer.
finally, layer six. There must be rapid interdiction procedures. If the money drops, agencies and banks need streamlined communication channels to freeze, recall, and return suspected fraudulent payments before they vanish into cryptocurrency exchanges.
Which happens in seconds.
Yes, it does.
So bringing this back to you, the listener, why should you care about all these administrative layers and legacy system upgrades? Because adding friction to an emergency system, it isn't about stopping people from getting help.
No, not at all.
It's about protecting the integrity of the safety net for when you actually need it. The data sharing agreements, the APIs connecting state and federal databases, the investigation protocols, these have to be built and stress tested before a crisis, not while the economic house is already on fire.
Absolutely. The lesson here isn't to make the system slower for everyone in a crisis.
Right.
Pandemic unemployment fraud became industrialized because organized criminals connected identity data and payment infrastructure much faster than the government and banks could connect their security controls.
Yeah.
The ultimate goal is to build an interconnected web today, integrating identity assurance and real-time checks before the funds ever need to move, so that when the next emergency hits, the system can instantly tell the difference between genuine human need and an organized looting operation.
We've covered a lot of ground today, tracing the path from Brooke Stewart's local Missouri scheme all the way to a $100 billion systemic breakdown of the U.S. emergency safety net. We've seen how legacy mainframes, dark web data, and siloed banking systems just created the perfect storm.
We have, yeah. And as we wrap up, there is one final detail from the source material that really demands consideration.
Oh, what's that?
We discussed how the perfect victims for stolen identity fraud are people who are administratively credible but lack regular access to monitor their digital footprints.
Right. Prisoners, deceased individuals.
Children, the unbanked.
Yeah.
As our society rushes headlong toward a purely digital financial future, this raises a really profound question. Does simply being offline or disconnected make you the ultimate invisible target for identity theft?
Oh, wow.
How do we protect the identities of those who aren't even looking at a screen?
That is a chilling thought to end on, because if you aren't actively watching your digital shadow, someone else might be wearing it. Next time you picture a bank heist, don't look for the high-tech lasers. Look for the cracks in the paperwork. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the systems around you, and we'll catch you next time.